content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. Hello, this is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. For the next hour, I'll be reading to you from The Week magazine. Today, we're reading from the September 2nd, 2022 issue of The Week. Our cover drawing this week, I guess I'd call it a clown scene. There's an old VW bug. It's painted in bright colors, green and red and yellow, with elephants and polka dots on it. There's a little Trump bumper license plate on the front. And three guys dressed up as clowns. It looks like one of them is Mehmet Oz. I think this is Herschel Walker, and maybe the other is the author, J.D. Vance. All guys that are running for the Senate endorsed by Trump. In the background, Mitch McConnell is standing in his usual suit with his hand on his head. The headline is the GOP blowing it? The, quote, bozo candidates who could cost Republicans control of the Senate. I think that's a talking points story. We'll try to get that later. But we'll start with the main stories and how they were covered. Trump's attempt to stall criminal investigation. What happened? Donald Trump left the White House with more than 700 pages of classified material, including some at the highest levels of classification, according to a letter to a Trump lawyer from the National Archives that was revealed this week. The letter, sent in May by acting U.S. archivist Deborah Steidel Wall, spoke of the urgency and important national security interest of having law enforcement and intelligence officials review 15 boxes of documents recovered from Mar-a-Lago in January, a move Trump's lawyers were trying to prevent. More than 150 documents were marked as classified. The tranche included some of the most sensitive secrets we hold, a government source told the Washington Post, including U.S. intelligence gathering methods. Trump's legal team petitioned a federal judge to appoint an independent expert to oversee the handling of the total of 26 boxes of documents seized from Mar-a-Lago and make judgments about Trump's claims of executive privilege. Legal experts said the 27-page motion was amateurishly drafted and confusing, and the judge, a Trump appointee, told his lawyers to revise their request and explain why the motion had been filed in her court instead of in Palm Beach County, where Mar-a-Lago is located. Meanwhile, federal magistrate Bruce Reinert said he would rule on whether to release a version of the affidavit that prompted him to approve the search after seeing the Justice Department's proposed redactions. Department officials have said releasing the affidavit would compromise their criminal investigation and endanger witnesses who had cooperated. What the columnist said: Trump is treating a legal problem as a political one, says Hayes Brown in MSNBC.com, and this time that strategy is likely to fail. The legal motion his hapless team filed this week was ridiculed by prominent lawyers as Trumpian gibberish. Meanwhile, a Trump ally released a National Archives letter that made it clear the FBI had shown the former president the patience of a saint as he stonewalled turning over documents for months. "It's not theirs, it's mine," he reportedly complained to advisors. The dangerously exposed former president may well be facing an indictment. For liberal Trump haters, seeing the bad orange man in handcuffs is a porn-like fantasy, said Michael Goodwin in the New York Post. But perp-walking the 45th president would come at a steep cost. Whatever Trump's flaws, tens of millions of Americans revere him as the only political figure who speaks for them and understands their alienation from the elite establishment. To see him hauled into court would make their estrangement permanent and create more dangerous rifts in our already fractured society. Trump deserves to be prosecuted, said Damon Linker in the New York Times. But this story will have no happy ending. Letting Trump off the hook for a host of possible crimes would tell him that if he wins a second term, he can do whatever he wants with complete impunity. Still, for a Democratic administration to prosecute a former GOP president and possible 2024 candidate would be incredibly dangerous, setting off a cycle of vengeance in which each incoming administration indicts its predecessor. It would also make Trump a folk hero outlaw to millions. Trump's contempt for the rule of law is so brazen, it cannot be ignored, said Heather Digby Parton in Salon. Letting Trump off the hook wouldn't be like Gerald Ford pardoning Richard Nixon and leaving a broken and disgraced figure to contemplate his crimes in solitary obscurity. Trump remains the de facto leader of his party, and if he gets a pass, we might as well declare that he has blanket immunity from criminal prosecution in perpetuity. Besides, letting Trump get away with multiple crimes would not ensure social peace, said Jamel Bowie in the New York Times. That's no longer possible. Thanks to Trump, much of the Republican Party has aligned itself against the basic principles of American democracy and has filled this year's ballot with election-denying candidates who vow to do whatever is necessary to keep Democrats from winning elections. Putting Trump on trial will be fraught, but there comes a point when we must act in the face of corruption, lawlessness, and contempt for the very foundations of our republic. The only way out is through. And a second shorter main story. Biden cancels $10,000 in student loan debt. What happened? President Biden signed an executive order this week to forgive $10,000 in federal student debt for each borrower earning under $125,000 a year. Students from low-income backgrounds who received Pell Grants can get up to $20,000 canceled. The plan, which is estimated to cost $300 billion, also extends the pandemic freeze on loan payments through the end of the year. About 45 million people in the U.S. owe a total of $1.6 trillion in student debt, more than is owed on credit cards or car loans, and black students are disproportionately represented because they have historically borrowed in much greater numbers than their white peers and borrowed larger sums. The executive order would give 40 million Americans some amount of debt forgiveness, while half of those would see their student debt evaporate completely. The vast amount of the relief, the administration said, would go to people making under $75,000 a year. Biden also proposed significant changes to the Education Department's repayment system. One would have the government cover the monthly interest on the debt for those who are making payments, so that balances will not continue to grow. Another would allow borrowers to limit payments to 5% of their discretionary monthly income, a drop from the current 10%. An entire generation is now saddled with unsustainable debt, Biden said. I understand that not everything I'm announcing is going to make everybody happy, but I believe my plan is responsible and fair. What the columnist said. What an enormous victory for progressives, said Suzanne Kahn in The Nation. The Higher Education Act of 1965 made college available, but only through personal debt. Now Biden is making an implicit call for a new paradigm, one that moves toward public investment. It's only a start. Some activists want forgiveness of up to $50,000, but Biden has made a clear statement about what we have gotten wrong in higher education policy. This plan makes absolute chumps out of those who didn't go to college, or who scrimped to pay back what they owed, said Charles Cook in National Review. Biden has let college-educated elites off the hook and pushed the cost onto you, me, and everyone else who pays taxes. Worse, the relief is just a one-off freebie. It does nothing to solve the problem of skyrocketing tuitions or help future students with the loans they'll take out next year. In just 4 years, overall student debt will return to its present level. Biden was hoping to avoid backlash by including means testing, said Paul Waldman in the Washington Post. But anyone who believes carefully designed policy will preclude GOP attacks is laughably naive. Whether the order canceled a little debt or a lot, Republicans would use the issue to stoke resentment. Will that help the GOP in the November midterms? Probably not. Student loan forgiveness is broadly popular, and Biden's executive order has given Democrats a chance to show voters that they're keeping promises. Controversy of the week, classified documents. Why did Trump take them? We still don't know the contents of the classified and top secret documents Donald Trump kept stashed in his safe, closets, and socks at Mar-a-Lago, said Timothy O'Brien in Bloomberg. But one central question is why? What were the former president's motives in taking at least 26 boxes of federal property to his home in Florida when he left the White House, and after he was compelled to turn over one trove of 15 boxes, why did he hide an additional 11 boxes in the basement? The potential reasons range from relatively harmless to deeply damaging. The most benign, Trump is a childish pack rat who liked collecting some of the cool doodads you get your hands on as president. A darker possibility emerges from the fact that the former president is saddled with about $1 billion in debt, with his struggling Trump organization facing massive legal and financial problems. Did he envision selling national security and nuclear secrets to foreign governments? It's also not unreasonable to worry that he was trying to hide evidence of compromising exchanges with foreign leaders such as Xi Jinping, Mohammed bin Salman, or Vladimir Putin. Whatever Trump's motivations, the frenetic pace at which Trump has seeded the ground with lies after the FBI's Mar-a-Lago search suggests he has something to hide. Trump clearly had a sense of entitlement about these documents, said Steve Bannon in MSNBC.com. He reportedly referred to the classified documents he often took up to his private quarters at night as mine, and ignored repeated, emphatic warnings from top advisors to follow security procedures and the Presidential Records Act. Over advisors' objections, he kept documents from security briefings, tweeted a sensitive spy satellite photo of a failed missile launch in Iran, and proudly showed off to visitors his love letters from North Korea's Kim Jong-un. Yes, but can anyone really rule out that Trump had nefarious motives? Asked John Bennett in roll call. The boxes of documents stored in a country club filled with unvetted, unmonitored visitors reportedly contained top-secret nuclear information, an intelligence dossier about French President Emmanuel Macron, and information about the Russia investigation. Throughout his life, Trump has sought either to increase his wealth-to-debt ratio or humiliate his adversaries. If Trump wanted to cash in, said Will Bunch in the Philadelphia Inquirer, his tangled web of dealings with Saudi Arabia suggests a possible buyer. The uber-wealthy Saudis want to build a nuclear plant, which could be used to produce the material for nuclear weapons. 2 weeks before the raid, a Saudi-backed golf tournament made a financially rewarding stop at Trump's Bedminster, New Jersey estate. The Saudis gave a whopping $2 billion to a fledgling venture capital fund started by his son-in-law and former advisor Jared Kushner. This all smells worse than a desert refinery and should be investigated. Trump's critics are letting their imaginations run away with them, said Tom Nichols in The Atlantic. They are setting up impossibly high expectations of finding a smoking gun of espionage or treason. If Trump is not charged with such crimes, he will claim exoneration. Trump should be held accountable for taking the documents, which may be a felony under a law he himself signed in 2018. But let's hold back on guessing games as to his motives and let the Justice Department do its work. So a good week, bad week piece. It was a good week for tailgaters with the news that despite inflation, the wholesale cost of bone-in chicken wings is now $1.68 a pound, lower than at any point since before the pandemic. Prices are expected to rise, however, with the arrival of football season. It was a good week for UFOlogists after the Senate Intelligence Committee drafted legislation directing the Pentagon to analyze a growing number of unidentified aerospace undersea phenomena that move rapidly from the atmosphere to oceans and appeared not to be man-made. It was a good week for turning off your phone and TV after a new Texas Tech study found that 1 in 6 Americans obsessively follow the news, live in a constant state of high alert, and see the world as a dark and dangerous place. But it was a bad week for too much thinking, with new research suggesting that extended periods of cognitive focus cause a buildup of toxic substances in the brain, meaning that burnout is an actual physical condition. Researchers said the only treatment is rest and sleep. It was a bad week for Maroom, a remote Australian town whose 220 residents have been trapped at home by huge herds of aggressive kangaroos. There are too many to count, really, said resident Karen Sutcliffe. And it was a bad week for Mariah Carey, whose effort to trademark the title The Queen of Christmas met with strong pushback from other singers. Among those objecting was Darlene Love, 81, who noted that her Christmas, Baby Please Come Home, was a big hit in 1963, and that unlike certain other warblers, she can still hit those notes. Briefing this week is titled Not Enough Teachers. An epidemic of teacher burnout has many school districts struggling to fill positions. Why are teachers unhappy? How big is the problem? In some parts of the country, it is serious, and school districts are getting desperate. Houston has about 900 teacher vacancies going into this school year. And to compensate for too few teachers, districts in Texas and rural Missouri are switching to four-day weeks. In Florida, there are about 8,000 teacher vacancies, and according to the Florida Policy Institute, about 450,000 kids started school last year without a permanent teacher. About 5,500 teachers quit Maryland schools in 2022, and Baltimore schools now have about 700 vacancies. Pennsylvania, Kansas, Alabama, Mississippi, and Georgia also report a crisis in staffing classrooms. Nationally, the percentage of teachers quitting soared to a record level in July 2020. But in the past year, the quit rate has dropped, and not all states or districts have shortages. Still, many of the nation's 3.1 million public school teachers have become deeply disenchanted with the profession. Nearly half of teachers polled in March say they intend to quit. And a recent survey of principals and school district leaders found that 72% did not have enough applications for open teaching positions. I have never seen it this bad, said Dan Dominick, executive director of the School Superintendents Association. Which districts are hardest hit? States are finding it hardest to retain staff in poor, rural, and urban districts, primarily serving students of color. In districts where more than 75% of the student body is non-white, about 10% of the teachers resigned or retired last year. That's up from 6.5% in 2019, and double the rate of districts where 90% or more of the students are white. In states with shortages, it's also far more difficult to find teachers for math, science, and special education classes. Nearly everywhere, teacher morale has plummeted, with 90% polled in January saying they are suffering from burnout. Why are teachers unhappy? The pandemic and politics are two primary factors. When schools closed their doors once the pandemic hit in March 2020, teachers had little time to prepare for a shift to remote learning, and the fits and starts reopening of school over the following year introduced a host of new problems. Some districts rejected masking requirements, and others struggled to enforce them, so coming to work meant daily exposure to COVID. More than 800 teachers died of COVID during the first year of the pandemic, and a recent survey found that 19% of teachers reporting that they suffer from long COVID. During remote learning, some students' mental health deteriorated, causing many to act out when they returned to school. In what way? In a 2021 American Psychological Association survey, 14% of teachers reported being physically attacked by students, and a third reported being threatened or harassed. At the same time, the struggle to make up for pandemic learning loss increased teachers' workloads and led to mounting pressure from increasingly antagonistic parents and micromanaging administrators. Many teachers say they've been pushed past the point of endurance. Every minute I wasn't with the kids, personally, I was beyond treading water with my mental health, said Bethany Collins, who quit in January after 8 years as a Los Angeles area middle school teacher. I was just drowning. How are local governments coping? Faced with a tighter labor market, many districts are raising base salaries and offering signing and relocation bonuses, up to a whopping $25,000 in one New Mexico school district. Some states are loosening eligibility requirements. In Florida, some military veterans are now eligible for temporary teaching certificates, even if they haven't completed a bachelor's degree. Arizona will now allow current college students to teach. But educators say that teaching is a profession that requires training and experience, so lowering the bar will only diminish the quality of classroom instruction children receive. Would we even be thinking about this if it was a pilot or an engineer or a doctor? Asked American Federation of Teachers President Randy Weingarten. It's part of the disrespect that you think you can just put a body in front of kids. Are there more long-term fixes? The country's struggle to recruit, train, and retain enough good teachers predates COVID. In the 2010s, enrollment in teacher preparation programs declined by more than a third, with some colleges reporting further double-digit decline since 2020. A 2018 University of Pennsylvania study found that 44% of newly minted teachers quit within their first 5 years on the job. Finding ways to reduce the cost of teacher training programs and the student debt burden could help make the field more attractive. So could support staff to relieve teachers from some non-classroom related administrative work. Without major changes, though, the pool of available teachers could continue to shrink, leaving those that remain with ever-ballooning workloads. In the last 2 years, I've had to be five teachers, said Nick Clark, who teaches high school at Fort Worth. The extra load and duties make coming back less and less appealing every year. And we'll move into some of the best columns of the week. First, yes, abortion will be on the ballot. In the post-Roe abortion dystopia, new horror stories are emerging every week, said Eugene Robinson. GOP-controlled state legislatures are passing draconian abortion bans that have turned once routine decisions about patient care into possible crimes, terrifying doctors and cruelly inflicting misery on women. In Texas, a woman having a first trimester miscarriage, with a fetus showing no cardiac activity, was sent home to suffer 48 hours of heavy bleeding and excruciating pain because the hospital was afraid that the necessary medical treatment might be prosecuted as homicide. In Nebraska, a teenager and her mother faced criminal charges for terminating the girl's pregnancy and bearing the fetus, based largely on evidence gleaned from private messages they exchanged on Facebook about abortion pills. In Louisiana, a woman 10 weeks into her pregnancy was told that although her fetus was missing the top of its skull, an unsurvivable condition, she had to continue carrying it because the state's abortion ban did not specify that condition as an exception. Heartbreaking cases like these will soon occur with horrifying regularity in GOP-controlled states. In the fall midterms, this modern-day inquisition will be on the ballot. Real leaders tell voters the truth. You know what's harder than speaking truth to power? Speaking truth to people, said Jay Nordlinger, because in a democracy, that's where power actually lies. In recent years, many conservative Americans have been sold a bill of goods by liars and hucksters to get their votes and their money. As a result of deceit and political cowardice, polls find that about 70% of Republicans believe that Democrats stole the 2020 election through massive fraud. That false belief led to a physical attack on the U.S. Congress, the worst attack on our Capitol since the War of 1812. Recently, Florida Governor Ron DeSantis has been campaigning for GOP Senate and gubernatorial candidates who are running on the big lie. And when asked if the election was stolen, DeSantis declined to answer. DeSantis was similarly evasive when questioned about his COVID vaccination status. "I've done whatever I did," he responded. That's a curious answer for a man who claims to tell it like it is. Political pandering will only reinforce the delusions of Republican voters. If you can't answer honestly and forthrightly when asked if President Biden won fair and square or if vaccination is a good thing, you're not fit to lead. This column comes from Columbia. Can we maybe hurry up for once? In Colombia, we are systematically late, said Marcela Melendez. We're never on time for work meetings, doctor appointments, or meetups with friends, even when we've booked months in advance. It's become known as a bad Latin American habit, to the point that foreigners making plans with us factor in an extra half hour or two because they know we'll operate on Colombian time. Yet this chronic tardiness is not just a harmless cultural quirk. It has a ripple effect on society that makes life harder for everyone. Respecting other people's time is a core courtesy that allows societies to function efficiently. Late to coffee with your friend? She might have to cancel her later plans. Miss half a work meeting? Your lack of foresight could force your colleague to stay after hours. And the worst part is, not only are we reliably late ourselves, but we get angry when others make us wait. In some friend groups, assigning blame for missing the show or the meal is a main topic of conversation. Imagine what it must be like in countries like Germany and Switzerland, where everything runs like clockwork. There, people set schedules and adhere to them. Workers go home on time, and social events include all those invited. How relaxing that must be. Well, this is the point in the show where normally we would do the last word, our feature article. But as I turn there today, I see that the first page of the two-page article is missing. First time that has happened. And so we'll pick up a few other things this week. Here's a business column. Real estate, a looming end to the long boom. The booming housing market is stalling out, said David Harrison and Nicole Friedman in the Wall Street Journal. Trapped between near-record prices and soaring mortgage rates, buyers are pulling back. In July, figures released last week show sales of existing homes slipped by 5.9%, a sixth straight month of decline. Sales of newly built homes fell even more, declining 12.6% for the month, and down nearly 30% from a year ago. Home building is also drying up, and mortgage applications are falling. Housing has seen prices advance relentlessly, rising 46% nationally in just the past 3 years. Now home affordability is the lowest it has been since 1989, and the market has turned quickly. The one reason prices remain high is that years of depressed new home construction following the 2007 to 2009 recession, have left the housing market undersupplied. Will home prices just flatten out or collapse, asked Jonathan Levin in Bloomberg. Both the industry and economic policymakers think it's likely to be the former. The Fed wants to make housing more affordable and bring home price increases down to 5% a year. But this is treacherous territory, and once prices start slipping, it's hard to predict where they will end up. Less than 6 months ago, home values in California were surging. Then San Francisco and San Jose saw steep declines. A few other markets, like Austin and Seattle, followed. Now prices are falling in 22 of the 100 biggest U.S. markets. Americans are less indebted now than they were during the mid-2000s housing crisis, which means there probably won't be a round of forced selling. But a lot of things have to go right to avoid a broad fall in prices. Homeowners and brokers are being too optimistic, said Jonathan Paciano in Forbes. Home builders, who may have the best insight into demand and cost, are much less confident. Close to one-fifth of them have slashed prices to help bolster sales or limit cancellations. This is starting to look more and more like a housing market recession. Americans who lived through the 2008 crisis may be watching the red heart market starting to cool and getting flashbacks, said Sigrid Forberg in Yahoo Finance. The situation today, though, is very different. Lenders have been far less lax, so there are fewer homeowners unable to meet payments. Overbuilding in the 2000s meant there was an oversupply of housing. Today, by contrast, there's a huge demand and a shortage of supply. Just remember that a 2008-style collapse is far from the only danger to the housing market, said Allison Schrager in Bloomberg. Even if there is not a steep decline, there will be a serious hangover from the very low rates in 2020 and 2021. The Fed brought interest rates to unnatural lows, as little as 2.65%, with its economic stimulus. Buyers who bought in 2020 and 2021 will be very reluctant to sell or trade up, and the housing market may be slower and less liquid for a long time. I'm one of those buyers. I got my house in 2021, benefiting from rock-bottom rates. Now I am not sure I can ever afford to move. Here's a Making Money article. Quiet quitting, burnout, or just slacking off? Young workers are checking out, said Erica Pandy in Axios. Last year, it was the Great Resignation. This year, the trend is called quiet quitting, as young people on Instagram and TikTok post videos of themselves proudly talking about how to slack off on the job. However you name it, the rise and grind ethos in hustle culture is losing its appeal for Gen Z. The rising approach is work to live instead of live to work. Don't leave your job, but focus on fun, fulfilling activities outside of work while staying on the payroll. Of course, it's easier to loaf when you're working remotely, and there's no pressure to show your face at the office from 9 to 5. But this new world of work may also be contributing to workers' dissatisfaction. Younger workers are craving mentorship and camaraderie they're not getting, and so they're disengaging. The quiet quitters say that they're just setting boundaries, said Lindsay Ellis and Angela Yang in the Wall Street Journal. The word quitting makes older managers believe the movement encourages people to be lazy, when it actually reminds them not to work to the point of burnout. It's inaccurate to describe this as the capricious behavior of entitled young workers who don't feel like trying anymore, said Clements Michelon in The Independent. This is an international movement, and the buzzword is terrifying bosses around the world. But the basic message is incredibly normal. Much of what companies have come to expect from workers is not reasonable, not productive, and not healthy. If you want to work productively almost the whole year, you'd be well advised to take a break and not look at work emails on weekends. You can skip looking at your email, said Rob Enderle in Computer World, but that has effects on your managers and colleagues too, and they'll notice them. When they figure out you're treading water, they'll understandably brand you with a reputation as an underperformer. That can damage your long-term career prospects, especially when employee records are shared digitally. Work-life balance is important, but avoiding being tagged as a slacker is too. The death of the American work ethic is a familiar trope, said Joe Constance in Bloomberg. In 1873, there was a vagabond scare after migrant workers hit the road to find opportunities. Similar conversations have played out in every decade since. These tropes get linked to the idea that people don't want to work. But in reality, it's more likely that wages aren't attractive enough for workers, said labor historian Joseph A. McGartin. If employers invest more in workers, they may get more in return. Wall Street's TikTok dilemma. If you've wondered what life is like at Wall Street's top banks, you have a new place to find out, said Ms. Paulina Cachero in Bloomberg. TikTok. For Wall Street, where confidentiality is bred in the bone, this poses a conundrum. Young employees have grown up used to sharing everything on social media. Videos that show off their work hard, play hard ethos are a potential recruitment tool, and just as surely as a potential source of embarrassment. J.P. Morgan's staff have posted videos of themselves partying on a boat cruise around Manhattan. Goldman employees show food trucks outside, and less appealingly, employees of banks have posted videos of analysts working past midnight. Some banks are encouraging their social media, but most Wall Streeters are cagey, happy to post videos, but leaving out one crucial bit, the identity of their employer. Thank you. We're on the health and science page. Belt of extreme heat to bisect the country. A swath of the U.S. from Texas to Illinois is becoming a zone of deadly heat, reports NBCNews.com. By 2053, that region will be home to more than 100 million Americans who will experience a combined humidity and temperature heat index of 125 degrees at least once a year, a level at which heat exhaustion is likely and fatal heat stroke is possible. That's the prediction of a new study from the nonprofit First Street Foundation, which analyzed property data to estimate the number of people affected. Climate change is causing temperature to rise and trapping more moisture in the atmosphere. Right now, some 8 million Americans live in areas exposed to that extreme heat combo. 30 years from now, the hot zone will cover 107 million people. The South faces the greatest chance of an increase in dangerous days, those with a heat index above 100 degrees, especially Texas, Louisiana, Arkansas, Missouri, and Florida. But Midwestern cities are also at risk. The heat belt encompasses St. Louis, Kansas City, Memphis, Tulsa, and Chicago. Part of the coastal mid-Atlantic and southeast will also see days with extreme heat. It makes certain places very difficult to survive, said climate scientist Noboru Nakamura of the University of Chicago, who wasn't involved in the study. I can certainly envision that would shake up people's decisions about where to live. Eat your grapes. British visitors tend to bring patients in the hospital grapes instead of flowers, and that may be hugely beneficial, reports The Independent. Eating the fruit could extend human life by 5 years and reduce the risk of Alzheimer's. A new study of mice has found that specific antioxidants in grapes improve neuron function, protecting the brain from developing dementia. Researchers put female mice on high-fat diets, and half of the group also receiving grape supplements. When they compared the liver, brain, and metabolic health of the mice, they saw that the group that ate grapes had higher metabolism, a longer lifespan, and a reduced risk of fatty liver disease. The grapes even changed the expression of the mice's genes, which co-author John Pizzuto from Western New England University in Massachusetts calls truly remarkable. The study contributes to a field of research investigating how people can switch their genes on and off more effectively, control their body's development. The result, Pizzuto said, adds an entirely new dimension to the saying, you are what you eat. Hip fractures in vegetarians. Vegetarian women are much more likely to break a hip in old age than those who eat meat or fish, reports The Times. In a study of 27,000 women ages 35 to 69, researchers at the University of Leeds found that as women grew older, the vegetarians were 33% more likely to break their hips than their meat-eating peers. Pescatarians, though, who eat fish but not meat, were no more likely to fracture their hips than carnivores. Over the course of the 20-year study, about 3% of the women developed hip fractures at an average age of 83. One explanation for the disparity is that vegetarians may eat fewer nutrients linked with muscle and bone health. That can lead to lower muscle mass and bone density, which increases vulnerability to injury. The vegetarians in the study also tended to have a lower average body mass index, which is linked to higher risk of fracture. Yet the solution isn't to abandon vegetarian diets, said lead author James Webster. As with any diet, it is important to understand personal circumstances and what nutrients are needed for a balanced, healthy lifestyle. We're on the Talking Points page now. We'll start with the article that was related to the cover drawing this week. U.S. Senate, why the GOP might blow it. Republicans appear to be realizing they nominated a bunch of bozos in critical U.S. Senate races, said Eric Lutz in Vanity Fair. The latest poll suggests that Democrats, who seemed headed for a midterms wipeout not long ago, are now favorites to retain Senate control. Last week, Republican Minority Leader Mitch McConnell publicly admitted he's not optimistic his party can gain a majority in the Senate, blaming a lack of candidate quality. He no doubt was thinking of Georgia candidate Herschel Walker, the former football star who's been accused of putting a gun to his ex-wife's head, has admitted fathering three out of wedlock children, and has attacked climate initiatives by asking, "Don't we have enough trees?" In Pennsylvania, former TV host Dr. Mehmet Oz is trailing by double digits after a series of comedic campaign blunders, including having to admit he owns 10 homes and not two, and a cringeworthy campaign video in which he bemoaned the high price of crudite ingredients. The bad news for Republicans doesn't end there, said Jim Garrity in National Review. Running to replace retiring Ohio Senator Rob Portman in a red state, venture capitalist and hillbilly elegy author J.D. Vance leads Democratic Representative Tim Ryan by just a few points in a seesaw race. In Wisconsin, GOP incumbent Ron Johnson is now trailing Democratic challenger Mandela Barnes, while in Arizona, the very Trumpy Blake Masters is in a tight race with Mark Kelly. Once vulnerable Democratic incumbents in Colorado and Nevada have built comfortable polling leads. Democrats are also getting help from events, said William Galston in the Wall Street Journal. Over the past 2 months, average gas prices dropped from $5.02 a gallon to $3.95, and inflation is trending down. Midterm elections are all about enthusiasm, and passage of the major energy and climate bill that many Democrats had given up for dead further lifted their spirits, while abortion bans are enraging and energizing women. McConnell is extremely shrewd, said Dean Obadalla in CNN.com, and his critique of Senate GOP candidates was meant to do more than lower expectations. He's also trying to put Trump's political future on this November's ballot. Trump handpicked many of the flailing candidates, and it's no secret he and McConnell loathe each other. If Trump-backed bozos bomb this November, McConnell wants Republican voters to know who to blame. Polio. It's back thanks to anti-vaxxers. We're time traveling, said David Axe in Rolling Stone, returning to that dark time before vaccines. An unvaccinated man in Rockland County, New York, was recently left paralyzed by polio, and the virus has been found in wastewater in neighboring Orange County and in New York City, the U.S.'s first outbreak of the incurable disease in more than 40 years. Created in 1955, the polio vaccine is 99% effective at preventing paralytic polio. But now the virus is reemerging, thanks to the insidious effect of vaccine disinformation and the backlash to COVID restrictions, said Leanna Wynn in the Washington Post. The Rockland case and wastewater data indicate there could be hundreds of people infected with polio who could be unknowingly transmitting the virus to others. In Rockland County, which has a large Orthodox Jewish community, the polio vaccination rate is about 60%. And for the unvaccinated, polio can cause muscle paralysis and even death. With resistance to childhood vaccination growing in many parts of the U.S., other vaccine-preventable diseases we've banished will also reemerge. We were on this sad trajectory long before COVID came along, said John Havlick and Howard Foreman in The Bulwark. Anti-vaccine and anti-science disinformation has been spreading for years on both the right and the left, and it exploded during the pandemic. Far too many Americans now believe their freedom depends on shunning vaccinations for themselves and their children, even though it means they may then spread infectious diseases to others. It's indisputable that vaccines save lives and have prevented an untold amount of suffering. If malicious skepticism about vaccines continues to proliferate, we will return to a darker past. In 1952 alone, polio paralyzed 21,000 people, most of them children, and killed 3,000, said Sarah Madad in CNN.com. Parents were afraid to let their children play outdoors for fear they'd wind up in an iron lung. As vaccine distrust grows worldwide, the immunity wall generations past have built is slowly being chipped away. Globally, vaccination against polio, measles, and other childhood diseases has fallen from 86% in 2019 to 81% in 2021, with 80% the threshold of herd immunity. Polio should have been relegated to the pages of our history books. Only human behavior and the choices we make can bring these defeated diseases back. The border. Abbott ships migrants north. A stunt by Texas Governor Greg Abbott has overwhelmed New York City and Washington, D.C. with an influx of thousands of border crossing migrants, said Herb Scribner in Axios. To highlight what he calls the Biden administration's open border policies, Abbott began in April to load migrants seeking asylum onto buses and shipping them to Washington. Since then, the arrival of some 7,000 homeless, hungry, and sometimes sick migrants has created a humanitarian crisis, said D.C. Mayor Muriel Bowser, who's asked the federal government for help. In August, Abbott started sending buses to New York, where the city has struggled to provide for about 800 arrivals. Mayor Eric Adams called the gambit hateful politics that uses desperate people as political pawns. In response, Abbott reminded Adams that New York is a sanctuary city for immigrants and that he should therefore welcome all migrants with open arms so that our overrun and overwhelmed border towns can find relief. What Abbott is doing is brilliant, said Mark Thiessen in the Washington Post. He's giving virtue-signaling northeastern liberals a taste of the disaster the Biden administration has unleashed by effectively hanging a big welcome sign on our southern border. Biden's failure to deter illegal crossings has put U.S. Customs and Border Protection on pace to surpass 2 million encounters with illegal migrants this fiscal year, the most since 1960. Liberals like Adams and Bowser cheered when Biden overturned Donald Trump's tough policy, said Charles Lipson in Newsweek. Now that they're being asked to pay the serious costs of housing and feeding so many people, these good liberals are not so welcoming. Abbott is stooping to a new low with this cruel stunt, which does nothing to deter migration, said Raul Reyes in CNN.com. As he faces a tightening re-election battle, Abbott is using vulnerable people who deserve respect and dignity as campaign props. Ironically, he's also doing them a favor, said Benjamin Wormund in the Houston Chronicle. The notoriously tough judges in Texas' largest immigration courts have denied 83% of asylum cases since October, while New York City courts have approved 82% of theirs. By offering a free ride north, said Austin Coker, an immigration expert at Syracuse University, Abbott is practically ensuring that these migrants will be allowed to stay in the country. Here are some of the shorter notes. It now costs an average of $310,605 to feed, house, and otherwise care for a child to age 17, according to a new Brookings Institution estimate. That's a record high and a 9% increase over 2 years ago. About 80% of the candidates Donald Trump has endorsed in competitive primary elections this year have won. 7 out of 8 Senate candidates he's backed won their races, as did 17 out of 21 House candidates. More Americans died in traffic accidents from January through March this year, an estimated 9,500, than in any first quarter of the year since 2002, according to the National Highway Traffic Safety Administration. Officials say a spike in reckless driving and traffic fatalities that began during the pandemic has continued unabated. In states such as Ohio, Wisconsin, and Pennsylvania, women have outnumbered men by 11% or more in new voter registrations since the Supreme Court overturned Roe v. Wade on June 24th. In Kansas, where a record number of voters rejected an anti-abortion referendum in August, 40% more women than men have newly registered. On the poll watch, 57% of registered voters, including 92% of Democrats, 61% of independents, and 21% of Republicans, believe investigations into Donald Trump should continue because the former president needs to be held accountable. And we'll finish up with, we'll get two quotes today. First comes from Theodore Roosevelt, who says, "Old age is like everything else. To make a success of it, you've got to start young." And another aging quote from William Shakespeare, who says, "With mirth and laughter, let the old wrinkles come." And with that, we have run out of time for today's episode of the week. Be sure to listen again next time. We hope you've enjoyed it. This is Fred Woodward reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind and print impaired. The week is available as a podcast on our website, ncreadingservice.org. For more information, if you have questions or comments, please give us a call, 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. And thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.